and welcome to another episode of Reality Check Fail, Pop Culture Radio. I'm Dan. With me is my co-host, Len. And today we have a very special guest. We have Marvel Now writer Dennis Hopeless.
Woohoo!
How's it going, guys?
Hey, pretty good. Thanks for joining us.
Of course.
So, just first things first, why don't you give us a little brief introduction about yourself, how you got into writing comics, and your work with Marvel and stuff like that.
Sure. I went to a state school here. I went to Kansas State for creative writing and video production. I wanted to be a screenwriter when I was in college. And the year after I graduated, my wife was doing a tattoo apprenticeship here in Kansas City. And there aren't very many opportunities for filmmaking in Kansas City when you don't have any money and you don't know anybody in the local community. So instead of trying to do that, I got a job at a comic shop and met artist Kevin Mellon through the owner of the comic shop and sort of figured out that I could do the same sorts of stories that I wanted to do in movies in comics with just one other collaborator. So Kevin and I started working on a short story first and then a couple of pitches, and that led to our first book, Gearhead, which came out in 2007. It was a four-issue miniseries from Arcana. And then after that, I spent about 6.5 years trying to get a second publication done. I wrote 900 pages, I think, of unpublished work between Gearhead and then an Image book that I did with Kevin in 2011 called Buckstruck.
Wow.
Yeah, so I did a lot of writing that no one will ever see. And the upside of that is you get a lot better when you do a lot of writing no one ever sees. The downside is it's extremely frustrating to work for 6 years and have no one see it. We were finishing up work on Lovestruck, which is it's like a 190-page graphic novel or something. And Kevin had several other paid jobs he was doing at the same time, so it took him several years to finish. But while I was waiting for that to finish and being very frustrated by all of these failed projects, I decided to put together just a sample packet to send out to editors. I kind of thought that there was no way my early work was good enough to get me work. And also, most of the stuff in the sample, I think legally they're not allowed to read, because you're really only supposed to send editors stuff that's already been published, because they, you know, for legal reasons, they don't want to read it. So what I did is I took my favorite finished, like, drawn and lettered scene from each one of those dead projects, created a logo if we didn't already have one, and then, like, pretended it was coming out from like, either as a website or from a publisher or whatever, and created, like, a title page for each one to explain the project, and then just had it printed at Kinko's and sent it out to, I don't know, 9 or 10 different editors at Marvel and DC. I got a couple of really nice emails back basically saying, we're not going to read this, but thanks for sending, you know, more stuff, which is kind of, I just wanted to build a rapport. Like, I wanted to create a relationship with editors or whatever. And, so nothing came of it. And then, like, I think it was 11 or maybe exactly a year later, Alejandro Arbona, who used to be a Marvel editor, emailed me out of the blue and said, hey, I finally got around to reading your packet. I really like it. Would you be interested in pitching something? And like a week later, he had me pitch Legion of Monsters miniseries that I did last year. And then while we were working on Legion of Monsters, I got X-Men Season 1. Yeah.
Great.
6 years of doing lots of work nobody sees, and then all of a sudden doing Marvel work.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories, and that's just kind of how it works. Like, you start getting frustrated, and you start going, oh, man, no one's ever going to see this. And then all of a sudden, you get, like, lots of little hands going on your projects. Like, oh, yeah, we want this, and we want this, and we want this.
Yeah, it is interesting how, I don't know, the hard part, I guess, is just sticking with it through the difficult times, the times where no one cares, no one knows who you are, and no one sees.
Yeah.
But, like I said, the upside is you get better with everything you write. So.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, yeah, Len and I are actually both aspiring writers. Len actually has had a couple short stories published.
Yep.
And we're both actually currently doing NaNoWriMo right now. I'm almost finished, so I'm doing pretty good myself.
Great.
I'm a little behind on my word count, but, you know, it'll be all right. It'll get done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the idea is just to write more than you would if you weren't doing it, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Okay, so You have two projects coming up for Marvel now. I think one of them is dropping this week, right? It's Avengers Arena coming out this week or next
week?
They
both come out December 12th.
December 12th, okay. Yes. So the first one we're going to talk about is Avengers Arena. The other one is Cable and X-Force.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was just going to say that I was looking through some of the news feeds recently about, you know, every month they say, oh, hey, look at what all the advanced reorders are, or the reorders, or what's being, you know, that sort of thing. And it looks like, Dennis, that you, with these two books, that you are the top of Marvel's advanced reorders.
Yeah,
X-Force even being number one.
Yeah, that's. I don't actually know what that means. Like, I mean, I get it. I worked at the store, so I know what FOC is, but I don't know what that means for our numbers. But that sounds great, right?
I think it means that people, when they first heard about it, decided, hey, I want to jump on, and then they've been talking to people and hearing more about it, and more people are saying, oh, crap, this book's about to come out. I want to read it.
Right.
All right, so let's start with Avengers Arena. Can you give us a brief synopsis of Avengers Arena?
Yeah, essentially, Arcade kidnaps 16 Marvel Universe teenagers, 15 teenagers in Darkhawk, and traps them on a mysterious island, which is his new murder world, and tells them, hey, you're 30 days from today, one of you gets to walk out alive. It's kill or be killed, teenage superhero deathmatch.
Okay.
And, basically it's just a long game, new version of Murder World, inspired by all sorts of deathmatch stories, both new and old, as our covers kind of obvious.
Yeah, you've got a lot of homage covers to Lord of the Flies and Battle Royale and other such projects like that. Now, was this actually something that you pitched to Marvel, or was it something that came to you and said, hey, we want to do something kind of like this?
Yeah, well, originally we were pitching a new... I was asked to pitch a new take on like Avengers Academy. Like it would be okay. New school, new teachers, new students, trying to figure out a new take on that because Christmas was graduating his kids and that book was ending. So I sent in like a couple page pitch of, you know, these are my characters I would use. This is kind of the school I would want. And here are a couple of ideas for arcs. And one of my arcs, I think the third arc I had was a like Triwizard tournament style competition between our students and maybe some other teenage superheroes from around the Marvel Universe that would then devolve into like a Battle Royale, Hunger Games type of situation when a supervillain took over. And it was just, you know, I was going to do like a 5 or 6 story arc based on that if my pitch got picked up. And we ran with that concept for a little while. I don't know, the editor liked what I was doing and we were talking about the characters and what was going to go on. And then my editor, Bill Roseman, and Tom Brevoort and Axel Alonso went to lunch to talk about the pitch and the book and what we were thinking. And Axel and Tom read through my document and said, this right here, this is the story. Like, we don't want, let's not bother with the whole school thing. Let's just do this. Let's make this a long story. So they came back to me and said, you know, you can do the same sorts of stories you want to do, but it's going to be in this setting. So, it was my idea, but it was sort of expanded into an entire series instead of just an arc.
Okay.
So I'm just real quick on that. How's the passage of time going to work in the series?
Yeah, we jump around a little bit. The first two issues take place day one in Murder World. And then I think issue three, we jump ahead. It's not, I know that the solicitations are interesting because I don't write solicitations. The editors.
Right.
And then they email them to us and, you know, we can make changes if we want to, but I have a tendency to just be like, well, it's ad copy, you know, whatever sells the book, that's fine. So the solicitations have made it seem more like a fight comic than it is. It's actually a pretty straightforward character study of all these characters. So at least the first 6 issues, you'll have a different POV character for each issue. You'll you know, get Lost style flashbacks with those characters to meet the new ones or to learn about the ones, the existing characters, and all of that will tie into what's going on in Murder World. So it's not like every issue is one day in Murder World or every issue is one death. It's just this is what this character is going through on the island, and this is who they are, and this is how they change and all.
Okay, well that makes me feel a little better.
Well, what other concerns do you have, Dan? I guess this is the time and the place, right?
Well, okay. My main concerns with the book is I actually really liked Avengers Academy.
Right, me too.
And I like Runaways. And I know you're using characters from both of those series along with other ones. Now, before I get into my concerns, are they all characters that we've seen before, or are there some new created characters that you made up for this just
based
story?
The characters who were going to be my primary cast for that, the other version of the book, are all new characters. So there's students from the Braddock Academy, which is like Captain Britain's Avengers Academy style British superhero school. And then there's a new character called Deathlocket, who's a female teenage Deathlocket. Those characters were characters that I repurposed from that original pitch that are new. On top of that, we have several characters from Avengers Academy. We've got X-23, Hazmat, Metal, Reptile, and I think there's somebody else. Justin and Sentinel. And then we have Chase and Nico from Runaways. We have Darkhawk from the Annihilation, Advent and Landing space stuff. And then an old, well, like the daughter of an old Marvel character, I think from the 70s, called Red Raven, I think is her name.
Okay.
Some of the characters don't play huge roles at the beginning of the book, and I haven't done the POV work yet. So I've done a lot more research on the characters who star in the first, what I'm on issue 7 now, on the first 7 issues of the book. So the kind of drawing characters from all over the place and then creating some new ones too.
Okay. So basically where my concerns were coming from is I always say that there's three types of comic book fans. There's the comic book fans who are only interested in creators. There are the comic book fans who are only interested in story. And there's the comic book fans who are only interested in characters.
Right.
I firmly fall into the final category. And I love certain characters. And I fell in love with Avengers Academy very quickly. I thought all the characters were brilliant. And I felt they have a lot of potential. So when I saw that they were being stuck in what is being marketed to look like Battle Royale, I immediately went, well, then basically this is just a book that's going to kill these characters I love. Why do I want to read this book?
Right.
So that's where my concerns were coming
from. Sure, and I totally understand that. I'm a big fan of all of the characters I put in the book. I've read every issue of Avengers Academy. I love Runaways. It's one of my favorite series of all time. I'm a huge fan of the Marvel Cosmic books. That's why I drew from those characters. These are all characters that I really like, and they're all characters that I don't necessarily want to kill. However, I'm writing a story that I think is important and is interesting and will be like a really good comic book series. And in that premise, some of these characters have to die. So you kind of had to take off my fan hat and just pick characters that would, you know, that I would be interested in writing, and not worry about, okay, some of these characters, if not all but one of them, are going to die. So I do completely understand people's apprehension about the concept. I also think we're telling a really interesting story, and I think that having stakes as high as they are in the book and having the kind of character work that we're doing in and around the scenario will like delve into the characters in a way that you couldn't do in a standard superhero story. I think the fact that these characters are so rich and so interesting makes them great for this kind of story. I mean, if you look at like Hunger Games is the most recent, most obvious inspiration for the book here in the States. That story lives or dies based on whether or not you find Katniss interesting. You're in her head. You know, it's not about her going around and killing a bunch of people. It's about what she's willing to do to get off of this you know, to get out of the Hunger Games, to get back home.
I want to bring up something, because a website posted an advanced review of the first issue. I want to get your opinion on this, because you were just saying how rich the characters are and stuff like that. In the review, the reviewer essentially said that the book works because these are C-list characters and they don't matter.
I've read the review you're talking about, and I don't think that's what he meant. I think what he was actually saying is if you took this premise and filled it with A-list Marvel heroes, you would know none of them were actually in danger. So therefore, the stakes would be less than believable, especially with someone like me writing it. You know, Marvel's not going to give me the keys to the biggest toys and say, hey, go kill them all. You know, maybe someone like Bendis or Hickman, they would be more likely to let that happen. But Spider-Man and Wolverine and Captain America aren't going to die in Murder World. These characters can. Right. So I don't think he's saying that the characters aren't interesting or aren't important. I think he just means you can believe that the stakes are actually this high because we could kill all of these characters and it wouldn't be a massive blow to Marvel's IP. I suspect that's what he meant.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to get your opinion on that, because when I read it, I was like, but...
Yeah, I mean, what I want to get across more than anything, and what nobody seems to believe me when I say this online, because I'm crazy and I read everything anyone has said about the book online ever. They think that we did an initial interview right after the cover and the concept for the book was announced. They did that Survive thing, like the teaser, and then like a week later they showed a cover and kind of talked about what the book was about. That was leaned very heavily toward the death angle. Like, we wanted to sell in that initial marketing that the stakes are going to be high. This really is a death match. It's, you know, it's not an alternate universe story. It's not a fake story. This is real. And we basically, the only thing we could talk about at that point was the basic premise and that it was legit. So there was a lot of mention, you know, I mentioned that people are really going to die. You know, there's a lot of characters in this book, but not all of them are going to survive. We went on and on about that. Everyone has taken that as gospel. Like, the book is just about death. It's just a meat grinder. It's just a bunch of characters being used as cannon fodder. And since then, as the marketing has progressed and we've gotten closer to the book coming out, I've been able to do more in-depth interviews. And so have, you know, the marketing has become more in-depth. And Kev and Bill, the editor, have done interviews and stuff where we sort of flesh out the idea and explain what the book's going to be about. And I see people online who think I'm lying. They think that I was telling the truth initially, saw the negative reaction to it, and now I'm backstepping and trying to wave my hands in front of your face and trick you into thinking that it's a character-driven book when it's really just a bloodbath. But it was marketing. Like, it was the direction of the marketing. You know what I mean?
Like you said, you're not in charge of the marketing.
Right, exactly. I'm not in charge of the marketing. I'm not in charge of what I can and can't say early on in the process. And this is just how the promotion of books work. Several months out, we kind of tease what the book's going to be about. And as we get closer to the book coming out, you can talk more about what actually happens in the book. But fans who are super livid about what happened, you know, about what we said in that initial interview, have just ignored everything that's been said since and just focused on this idea that it's just a meat grinder. And I promise you, if I can promise you nothing else about the book, that it isn't just a meat grinder. It's a character story. Like, we're putting these characters in a worst case scenario and showing you what kind of person they are, like, deep down inside, when it's fight or flight, when it's save your friend, save yourself, or kill. Like, how does each character deal with that? How does each personality fit into that? And what are they willing to do? That's what the book is about. It's not about a bunch of fights for some, you know, like a cockfight or a dog fighting or something. It isn't that. It's about the psychological implications of this worst case scenario.
Yeah. I was wondering real quick, I'm going to base this question a little bit off of one of the references you made earlier. As we've talked about Avengers Arena more and more, I've started to feel, you know, because the first time I heard of this, I was like, okay, so this is just a big way to get us to not make fun of Arcade anymore, right? But I'm thinking, you mentioned Lost, and you mentioned the point of view characters per issue and that sort of thing. So I'm thinking, is Lost actually a really big influence on this?
Yeah, we were influenced by a lot of different things. When initially, I mean, like I said, early on, the Triwizard Tournament from Harry Potter was probably the biggest influence. And then from there, as it became a larger story, I started to look at things like The Running Man, which I love. My favorite movie as a kid was The Running Man. I love that. Or, like Gladiator. Or, I reread Battle Royale. I reread Hunger Games and watched the movie. So I wanted to... A lot of times when you're doing a story that's similar to something, you try to avoid looking at all the other things like that so that you don't draw too much influence from it. In this case, we kind of went the opposite way. Like, I looked at everything that this idea was sort of inspired by to see what elements of that we could use or what worked or what would be interesting, what would be a new take on this idea. And Lost was definitely... I rewatched the first season of Lost to see the story structure. Because I think the most interesting thing about Lost is it's got a really big cast, and early on in the series, I can remember watching it and being disappointed when I figured out that, like, the Korean characters were going to be the POV character for that episode. I was like, oh, I don't care about these two. They don't even speak English. And I ended up loving them at the end of the episode because it was so well done. And so over the course of that first season, you really get to know all these characters, and you care about not just the situation and the plot, but what it's doing to these individuals. And so, yeah, we drew a lot of inspiration from that.
Well, great. Okay, well, you know, this book has a lot going for it, and for me at least. It has characters that I really like. It's got Kev Walker art, which I was a huge fan of his run on Thunderbolts with Jeff Parker.
Yeah, this book is so gorgeous. So, it is so... I mean, I know we've shown some preview art, so you've kind of seen it, but it's amazing. Kev, he nails the facial expressions. He makes the characters all look like actual teenagers, and they're not all the same age. They don't all look 17. Like, some of them look 14. Some are 15, some are 16. You know, I mean, he really does an amazing job of drawing the characters to have a lot of personality, which is so important for a book like this.
Well, actually, you know what? I want to go back to another question, because Len was just asking you about Arcade. Now, are they just all trapped on an island and he's having them kill each other, or is he actually broadcasting this to people? Or is that part of a spoiler?
That isn't explained 100% until, I think, issue 7, exactly what he's doing. In the first issue, he kind of comes up and tells them the score and goes a long way toward proving to them that they're not going to just escape and beat him up. And then he kind of just sinks down into the background, and it becomes about the character, you know, their interaction until issue 7, where we kind of focus on Arcade again. So, he's got designs and he's doing different things, but that's not a big part of the early arcs of the story.
Okay. Well, you've put my mind at rest. I'm going to be picking up issue 1, so I want to see what happens. So.
I never really followed Runaways or Avengers Academy, but I think I might have to grab it too.
You know, it's funny. I feel like I'm really the two things I'm the worst at in my professional life are summary and promotion. I'm not very good at summarizing a story in a way that makes it sound super compelling, and I'm not very good at, like, knowing how to promote something. So I do these interviews that are regimented, that aren't just me talking to someone, and I feel like I always sound like an idiot. And then I go read online, and I hear that people think I sound like an idiot, and then I'm lying, or that I'm not promoting the book properly. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. Like, that's not my skill set. So it's nice to be able to just kind of chat about it and explain myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like I said, you sold me, so...
Did I answer your arcade question? Maybe I didn't answer your arcade question.
Oh, no. I'm satisfied.
Okay. Yeah. He was basically just saying, like, oh, this is a big ploy so we don't make fun of Arcade anymore. He's always been kind of a joke.
Goofy bow tie, goofy white loud outfit. You know, he's got this little, prison whatever set up. It's called Murder World. Right. And somebody is inevitably going to have to fight to the death, only they break out and beat the crap out of him instead.
Yeah, we came to it from the opposite way, from perspective. Like, we built the story and figured out that it was going to be Arcade to set this up. Like, it made the most sense of all the villains in the Marvel Universe for it to be either Arcade or Mojo, and I prefer Arcade. I'm sorry, Mojo is not for me. And then from there we realized, okay, this has to be a new Arcade. You know, it's the same guy, personality is the same, but he has to have like a new motivation for this. There's got to be a reason why he's changed the rules and is going to make it more legit. So we started tinkering with the character after the fact. It wasn't just like, oh, I like Arcade, so I'm going to make him really cool. It was, if Arcade's going to do this, we have to make him believe that he's capable of. So
right.
Okay. Now, you're writing another book, yes. Which both Len and I are very excited about, because Len is a huge Cable fan.
Not just because I'm tall, but I'm actually a gigantic fan of the character.
And I'm a huge fan of Domino. She's my favorite X-Man. It's like a tie between her and Blink. So so we're very interested in Cable and X-Force. So can you tell us a little bit where this book is coming from post Avengers versus X-Men?
My initial pitch for the book was Cable and Hope after AVX are both in a weird place where they're kind of, they've accomplished their goals. Like, both of them have this weird mutant messiah thing, and, you know, Cable's always had his TO virus and his Aksani son, I'm supposed to save the present so the future doesn't happen sort of thing. And they're both just sort of done with that. Like, they showed in AVX Consequences that Hope has decided she doesn't want to be an X-Man anymore. She wants to just live a normal life. And I thought that was a really interesting idea. And one of my favorite Cable stories was the stuff where he was in the future with Hope raising this daughter in a post-apocalyptic wasteland. I love that idea. I love what that did for the character. And I think that's the most interesting stuff about Hope. So I wanted to show, what is it like for these two characters who are really bad at living in the present as normal people, trying to live normal lives, and how can we screw with them and make that absolutely impossible in a way that you know, creates a compelling superhero comic? So I started thinking about who Cable is and his past and what he's good at, and it made sense to me that he would be the perfect character for like a one last scores type of situation where, okay, I'm going to live a normal life. I'm going to try to have a relationship with my daughter who's living a normal life. But I have to do this first. I got to save the world one last time. And then once I've done that, maybe we can go on and be normal. And like all good one last score crime stories, it goes horribly awry. And by the end of the first arc, Cable and X-Force are like Marvel's most wanted mutant terrorists and running around trying to save the world while the Uncanny Avengers and everyone else is trying to bring them in because they think they're criminals. So,
okay.
Yeah, that's the premise of the book.
Well, along those lines, though, I'm also a little curious, and I know, especially since I'm going to be mentioning another book here, that there will be even less that you could probably say, but I'm actually curious, given that synopsis, that setup for Cable and X-Force, I'm wondering how or if or when they might interact with the Uncanny X-Men that's coming up, you know, because they're kind of going to be, you know, Cyclops on the run and that sort of thing too.
Sure. It's on my, well, it's interesting how these things work. Like, you pitch the stuff not knowing what other people are doing, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know, I knew, they told me what was going to happen at the end of AVX. In loose terms, before I pitched it, like, this is where these characters are going to be. This is kind of what we're looking for. They said they wanted a cable-led X-Force team, and I pitched from there, not knowing, not having any idea what, you know, what Brian's plans were, what the plans for Cyclops were, what the plans for X-Men were. So yeah, I didn't really know that was going to be a book with a similar concept. Now the tone of that book is very different, and the story is very different from what we're doing in X-Force, but it does make a lot of sense for Cable and his dad, who are kind of on similar paths at the moment, to to interact. I don't know that, you know, that's kind of the flagship X-Men title, and it'll be up to Brian whether he is interested in crossing over or having some sort of connection. Ooh, Brian, the editorial, Nick Lowe. So I would love to do something. It's definitely on my list of potential future arcs, but it's not up to me, and I'm not sure when that would happen. We're definitely crossing over with Sam Humphrey's Uncanny X-Force relaunch book. I think that's the fourth arc. And we're going to have a big Uncanny Avengers storyline in our third arc. It isn't a crossover. We're not crossing over with what Rick's doing. It really is just on that relationship. So, yeah, I mean, it's up there. It's on my list. I mean, if it were up to me, I would use every interesting character from Cable's past that I want to, and in whatever way that I want to, but whether we'll get there or not, I'm not sure.
Well, you know, a lot of the interviews that I've read and a lot of the marketing has mentioned Cable, and it's mentioned the team lineup. And so far, all I've really heard is this is the home book for Hope, and you've already mentioned a little bit of her mindset, as you know, especially the mutant messiah bit. Is there anything else that you can tell us at this time about her placement? Because I really love the character. So,
yeah, I'm a big fan of Hope too. The interesting thing to me is that Hope is she's a teenage female Cable, basically. She was raised by Cable. Like, everything she knows about the world is this post-apocalyptic, the road wasteland, and then this weird militant dude who's crazy powerful and carries guns around. Like, she was raised by, I mean, it's kind of like The Professional. You ever seen The Professional with Natalie Portman when she was a kid?
Oh yeah, great movie.
She was raised by this badass, but at the same time, he doesn't talk much. So Hope is like a talkative female version of Cable, which makes her really interesting. And the fact that she's so young and is now being thrust into, like, normal modern teenage situations, she's totally unprepared for that. Like, give her a Mad Max wasteland and a bunch of people she's got to kill, she can do that. But put her in high school, and that's a different story altogether. So at the beginning of the series, yeah, Hope is really struggling with that decision she made. I'm going to live a normal life. Oh, this is what a normal life looks like. Maybe that was a bad idea. And then she gets sucked into Cable's nonsense, and their relationship and what their sort of competing agendas are a big part of the book going forward from there.
Okay, great. We're going to talk about a couple of the characters. I'm, of course, going to bring up Domino now, because Domino is an odd character because she's been kind of portrayed all over the place. I mean, she's been the serious assassin, and then when someone else gets a hold of her, she's kind of sexy and funny, you know, wisecracking. How do you see Domino in your title?
I kind of see her as all of those things. Like, she's very good at her job. She's very good at, getting in and getting out and getting the job done, and is no nonsense when she's doing that. But when she's off duty, you know, she believes in living hard and playing hard. And I think it's interesting that she's on a team like this, like a very, you basically don't get to interact with anyone else on a regular basis, because if you do, you'll go to jail. And she's on a team with her bizarre, quiet, brooding ex. And both of them have done a lot and have seen a lot and have changed a lot since they were together. And so that, it makes for an interesting environment for Domino to be in. So we're going to see all those different sides of her as she sort of tries to deal with, you know, her emotions about, because before this, she was just a legit X-Man, you know, like, for a long time, Domino was the X-Force girl and the militant mercenary type of a character. She's a mutant, and she worked well on X-Force, but she was never like the blue and yellow tights type of X-Man. But in Brian Wood's X-Men series, she was. So she's coming right out of being like a legitimate superhero and being thrown back into this weird version of her past. And I try not to discount... I feel like I'm not answering your question at all, but I try not to discount any version of the character. I just figure out a way to fit that into a person that I can understand, you know? Because Cable's kind of the same way. He's been a lot of different things over the years, and he's been portrayed a lot of different ways. So I try to figure out, like, if this crazy business is his past, like, if all of that stuff actually happened, what would that guy be like now? Like, what would his personality be like now? And what elements of those things would still linger? And what things has he grown out of? And so I did that with both Cable and Domino.
Okay. Yeah, no, you definitely answered the question. Going back to that, are we going to see, like, previous aspects of Cable, like, when he was, like, the mutant messiah, like, when he had, like, the big scimitar and everything like that, the big stick? And
I would imagine we'll address it. I like that stuff. I had a really fun time going back and reading all the crazy different incarnations of Cable. we'll definitely address it. But for the most part, he's the brains of the operation and the guy with the biggest guns in this... He's been cured of his TO virus, which should make him the most powerful, you know, telekinetic and telepath in the Marvel Universe. However, there are some other issues that he's dealing with that kind of knock him back down to a more reasonable level. So, yeah, Cable's in an interesting place.
Okay. So the other characters in the remaining of the cast is Colossus, mm-hmm. and Forge, and Dr. Nemesis, yes. correct?
You know, I tell people the lineup, because, you know, especially coming off the promo pictures, and I'll tell people, you know, and I'll explain all the old favorites, you know, Domino and Colossus and Forge, and then I'll say Dr. Nemesis, and I always get asked, who the hell is Dr. Nemesis? So, if you don't mind, take a minute for our listeners and say, who the hell is Dr. Nemesis?
Dr. Nemesis is like a weird science mutant. I think the best way to describe Dr. Nemesis is he has a gun that fires syringes. he's fun to write because Matt Fraction always said that he tried to write Dr. Nemesis with Warren Ellis's voice. Dr. Nemesis was a character that Warren was going to use and never got around to using him when he was doing his X-Men stuff. And so when Matt took over Uncanny, brought him in and made him Warren. So yeah, he's like a mad scientist, ageless mutant Warren Ellis. So really fun to write.
That's funny. Okay, so the movie has Colossus. You know, I've never really been a big fan of Colossus, so I'm not going to talk about him.
Colossus is in an interesting place, though. In AVX, his sister, like, at the end of AVX, it became clear that his sister really did a number on him. And because he's very tortured at the moment. And the worst thing in the world for Colossus right now is to be a very, very famous criminal.
That's the thing about Colossus. He gave up everything for his sister, pretty much. He killed himself at one point because he wanted to get rid of the legacy virus and everything just because of her. And she's just crazy go nuts. So it's like, anyway. The last one is about Forge. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought Forge was dead.
Forge appeared to die. In Warren Ellis' Ghost Boxes storyline, he was in Wondagore Mountain, and he had built these weird, like, proto-mutants or something, like a race of mutants to fight another race of mutants from an alternate dimension that were going to invade the 616 dimension because there were no mutants left. And Forge had sort of gone insane obsessing over this idea. And, so at the end of that, he refused to leave, and this big, crazy sword laser came down and blew up Wondagore Mountain. But we did not see Forge die. So,
okay. Nobody not dead.
If you read the Marvel Now .1 anthology that came out, whenever it came out, last month, 2 months ago, I did an 8-page Forge story in that explains how Forge got from where he was in Ghost Boxes to the not quite so crazy and not dead version that we're using.
Okay. I'm going to have to go find that. That sounds very interesting.
It's a visually very interesting read as well. I do remember that, and I didn't realize that he was coming straight out of Ghost Boxes with that story. So that makes a little bit more sense now. We have to go back and look at it again.
Yeah, the first page originally had a bunch of captioning over it that explained what happened in Ghost Boxes and set all that up. And Nick just said it was going to be confusing for people who hadn't read Ghost Boxes because it was so long ago. So we kind of just. It's almost like an Easter egg for people that remember that's what was going on there, as opposed to being explicitly, well, he was in Wondagore Mountain and then exploded him, which I did say that at the beginning of my first draft.
All right, well, I have to tell my questions for X-Force. Len, do you have anything else about X-Force?
Oh, I'm just curious, since I'm the biggest Cable fan ever, well, at least according to Dan, I was wondering, you've mentioned a few things already. Cable and Hope in the Wasteland in the future. But I was wondering what a few of your favorite stories or arcs with Cable and X-Force were.
Yeah, I really liked that one. As weird as it was, I was a really big fan of Cable and Deadpool, what it was called.
Yes.
It's a strange version of the character because he's super powerful and decides to fix the world. Like, he's almost like one of the Phoenix Five.
Pretty much.
But I thought it was really fun, and I wish we had Deadpool on the team just because they play off each other so well. Like, they have a very interesting dynamic. Yeah, I really enjoyed that stuff. I went back and reread Joe Casey's run from when he had the scimitar and was dating the woman at the coffee shop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was actually the run that actually got me into reading Cable, thanks to Len. He said, you should read this. And I was like, wow, this is really good. And then we went from Joe Casey into Robert Weinberg stuff, which was also really good.
It's interesting to go read that stuff from that era because Marvel was still doing these like elaborate long storylines. Like the Apocalypse storyline starts before Joe Casey's like 40 issues or whatever it is and ends after.
Yeah. So
his entire run is like the middle act of a three-act Apocalypse story that was written by three different guys.
I really wish they would have let him do the 12 storyline that he wanted to do. Instead of giving it away and then making it a big Marvel event. I mean, I understand why they did it, but I just from what he said about the story that he wanted to do, it sounds like it would have played off so much better than having Cyclops and Apocalypse merge.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
you know, my favorite story from that run is, I think it was his run, was the crazy old guy in the basement who's convinced he's from a world where nobody ages and he builds a weird spaceship. You guys remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Yes,
like
yes.
Homeless
guy,
I remember that.
Insane, and he thinks he's from another world where people don't age, and his wife is there waiting for him, and he's been slowly dying since he's been on Earth, so he's built this crazy gasoline-powered spaceship in the basement of Cable's girlfriend's building. And
I remember that.
Thinks he's going to fly off, and he ends up blowing the building all to hell.
I think my favorite one from Joe Casey's run was actually the man, the guy in the suit who just...
Yeah, that stuff was really fun. Like he went weird, interesting places with the character, and yeah, I had a really good time rereading. I mean, I read it all back in the day, but rereading it was fun.
My favorite was probably the issue where it was essentially a prose issue of Lee Merriweather's journals.
Oh, yeah.
And like the half of every page would be one picture, and then it would just be the journal for the rest.
Right.
That was an interesting, because it changed the psychology of the book too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that whole run had great Ladron art and
oh,
everything.
Oh God,
so
yes.
It was just...
Lee Merriweather was in Cable and Deadpool too, right? Or Cable Deadpool too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
She was. Yeah. She ended up being like Prime Minister of Providence at one point.
Right. Right.
It's fun to go back and try to figure out ways to pull in those characters that haven't been used that much since. So yeah, look for favorite Cable supporting cast characters to pop up here and there in Cable and Elseworlds.
Awesome. Cool. Okay. All right, Dennis. Well, that's all our questions. So well, thank you again. Do you want to go ahead and plug anything? You want to plug the books and?
Yeah. Cable and Elseworlds number one and, Avengers Arena number one both come out December 12th, and then both series have a second issue out 2 weeks later. So there'll be two issues in December.
Okay.
Also in January, Mike Norton and I have a Dark Horse miniseries called The Answer that starts up. So look for that.
Oh, very cool.
And yeah.
Okay, and you're also on Twitter.
Yes. I think Hopeless Dent is my Twitter, at Hopeless Dent.
Mm-hmm.
DENT. It's stupid, but I very foolishly used like a weird name that I used in college for creating all of my names on message boards and Twitter and such. So I'm stuck with Hopeless Dent.
I did the same thing. I know how that is.
Likewise.
Well, thank you again for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to answer our questions and put my mind at ease about Avengers Academy.
And make me more excited about
or Avengers Arena. Sorry. Avengers Arena, my apologies.
Yeah, no, it's fun. Thanks a lot, guys.
All right. Well, I guess I'll wrap up this episode of Reality Check Fail. Until next time, we'll catch you later.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Reality Check Fail, Pop Culture Radio. You can email us comments or questions at realitycheckfail@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/realitycheckfail or on Twitter at Pop Culture Radio. You can also visit our website at realitycheckfail.com. Thanks again for listening, and we hope to catch you later.